Okay, we're bringing the House Resources Committee meeting today to order. We are in Capitol Room 124. We have Representative Armstrong, Representative McCabe, Representative Rauscher, Representative Sadler, and myself, Chairman McKay here. So we do have a quorum. We have Representative Kronk in the audience. Welcome, Representative Kronk. I'd like to thank Justin and Zach, our staff, and committee aide Ed King today for helping us keep the meeting going smoothly. Please silence your cell phones. We have four items on today's agenda. Our first item is House Bill 120, which is related to non-resident student hunting and fishing licenses. I will now bring House Bill 120 back before the committee. My goal for today is to take public testimony, finish work on this bill, and look to the will of the committee. So, public testimony on HB 120 is now open. Does any member of the public wish to testify, either in the room or online? Okay, we have one person online, John Anderson. John, can you hear me?
For the record, my name is John Anderson.
Okay, John, if you already stated your name, that's good. Please give us your affiliation and where you're calling from and begin your testimony.
So, for the record, my name is John Anderson, and I'm a graduate of the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I currently live in Fairbanks, Alaska, and I'm calling in support of this bill because this bill is actually something that I thought about when I was attending the University of Alaska almost 10 years ago, where one of the organizations I belonged to, we actually attempted to do a fishing trip, and certain members of our organization could actually not attend due to the cost of getting a one-day or a three-day fishing license. It really did kind of price them out of it, especially with some of our plans. We wanted to do an ice fishing event. We rented a cabin on Birch Lake, and only a handful of us who were residents were able to attend. So this is something that I, thought about then, and it's just something that, we can really hook some of our counterparts. We can build stronger organizations. We can build stronger links to Alaska, and we can also, even if the non-residents don't stay, but they took advantage of it, that's something they're going to remember for the rest of their life. They're always going to have that experience, and they're always going to want to come back to Alaska to either show their families the experience they had, whether it's fishing or hunting. And if they come back at a later point and they're not residents, well, that's just more money they're spending into our local economy. On the other side, if they stay because they got so hooked onto fishing or hunting, well, or trapping even, and we're just building our workforce we're building our economy that way, because now we have skilled residents who hopefully, graduated through the university system, and then they want to stay here. They have that connection. They're not just going to be here and then leave. So for all those benefits, I kindly ask the committee to pass this bill out of committee. And like I said, it has my full support, and I know many in my organization through the university, throughout the years, talked about very similar things where they wish they had something like this. They had that better bonding experience.
Okay, John. Well, thank you very much for that. I didn't catch your organization. I don't care.
So it was Sigma Fraternity through the chair.
I still didn't quite hear. I heard fraternity, but I didn't get the name, and I thought maybe we should have that on the record. Go ahead, please.
Through the chair, Representative McKay, it is Sigma Phi Epsilon Fraternity at the University of Alaska.
Sigma Phi Epsilon. I think they made a movie about you guys. Okay. Thank you, John. We appreciate your testimony and glad we're able to help your group entertain friends in Alaska. Does anyone else wish to testify? Got another one. And the name? Alan. Al Barrett. Okay, Al Barrett, can you hear me all right?
Mr. Chairman, can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Go ahead. State your name and your affiliation and begin your testimony, Al.
Yeah, thank Resources Committee. My name is Al Barrett. I reside in Fairbanks. I'm also a member of the Board of Game currently, and these are my own views and opinions, not the views and opinions of the Board of Game. I also support HB 120, would ask you to also support it. You know, these non-qualified residents have been invested a lot of time and finances in our state education system, and I believe allowing these students to participate in hunting and trapping and fishing at a resident fee would benefit the student and the state. Currently, the state and NGOs, some NGOs in the state, are participating in a nationwide program called the 3 R's, and that's recruitment, retainment, and reactivate. And these demographics of these college students are falling into one of those three categories, and this would, you know, help promote hunting, fishing, and trapping within the state. And lastly, the more people participating in buying licenses, it means fewer general funds are needed for the fish and wildlife management in the state. But again, I just ask you to support this and move on to the next committee, Mr. Chairman, and committee members.
Okay, thank you very much, Al. We appreciate your testimony today. Is there anyone else wishing to testify? Okay, we have no one in the room and no one online. So I will now close public testimony. My office did not receive any amendments. Does the sponsor have any closing comments? Oh, okay.
For the record, Michaela Anderson, Chief of Staff to Representative Tom Chesky. Moving forward, I wanted to clarify a couple questions or answer a couple questions that were asked at the last committee meeting, if that's okay. The $5 and free license exemption relates to low income. So if somebody falls below the poverty line, they already get a well-reduced fee on their license. And but if they're dependent on their parents and they don't fall under that, that's when this would activate, if you will. As that. As far as large game hunting, this does not make them a resident. This deals strictly with licenses. It does not deal with tags, stamps, or other regulations. So as far as large game muzzle loading, they would still have to go through muzzle loading training, which was a question about training. And as far as large game, if they wanted to go bear hunting, they would still need to be guided. So, you know, if a student wants to pay or their family wants to pay for a guided hunt, but they qualify under that, you know, that's $200 for the hunting that they would get that discount. But again, this just deals strictly with licenses. And then to reiterate, this would not qualify for dip netting because, again, not a resident. And I believe that those were the main questions that were asked. And then as far as salvage, they would still fall under any salvage laws. And that's the same as any resident or non-resident hunter that's not a student. So if they shoot a moose, a bear, anything large, I mean, even something small, they would still have to pack it out and utilize it, you know, respectfully. So those are
okay, very well.
Adjusting those questions.
Okay. Thank you for that. And Ms. Anderson and Representative Armstrong has a question.
Thank you, through the chair. I love this bill, and I'm sad I didn't think about this before the amendment deadline. But I was curious if y'all had considered non-resident exchange students, high school students, since the license age is 16. And we have so many exchange students in the state and really robust programs. And obviously a big part of getting to experience Alaska is recreating in the outdoors. Curious if you consider that. If not, maybe we can talk if that would be a friendly amendment on the floor, just so that non-resident kids who aren't in post-secondary could participate.
How old do you need to be to even need a fishing license?
16.
So you, okay.
Through the chair, Representative Armstrong, we have not discussed that, but would love to have that conversation. Also, just to kind of go back on the student portion of it, there was a question about how would we know if they're a student. That would go under certification. So basically they would sign something after speaking with the department. They would sign something that says, I certify I'm a student. And then if law enforcement stops them, they would have to go through that route of basically proving that they're a student or dealing with consequences, which we aren't aware of what those exactly would be otherwise. So,
yeah, also, Frank, Tom, or Representative Tom Chesky, for the record, through the chair. That's a great question, Representative Armstrong, and certainly willing to look at that before it goes to the floor.
Thank you. Yeah, I'll schedule something with your office.
Very brief at ease. Okay, we're back on the record. Representative Sadler, you had a question?
Thank you. A question through the chair to Representative Thomas Jeske, the sponsor. Do we know how many students, well, first of all, how many students are there in the university system? How many full-time, how many part-time? I'm just curious to find out how extending this non-resident post-secondary student license would affect the demand on our fish and game resources. So the only way to measure that is how many students there are and then how many fish and moose they might take.
Yeah, so through the chair, Representative Tom Chesky for the record. So in Anchorage, there's about 1,200. And in Fairbanks, I think there's almost 700 non-resident full-time. So that's kind of the estimated number.
Follow-up, Representative?
And through the chairman, Representative Tom, that's a full-time non-resident. We know how many are part-time non-resident.
I don't have that number broke down.
Very good.
Through Chair, Representative Sadler, we're happy to circle back with you.
By when?
I will ask the university those questions as soon as we're out of committee.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, I look now to the will of the committee, and Mr. Vice Chairman, you have a motion, please.
Mr. Chairman, I move to report House Bill 120, Work Order 33. -LS0633/A from committee with individual recommendations and 3 attached, 0 fiscal notes.
Hearing no objection, HB 120 has been reported from the House Resources Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal 0 notes. We will take a brief at ease to sign the report. Okay, we're back on the record. Our next item on today's agenda for House Resources is HB 104, which is related to expedited timber sales. I will now bring House Bill 104 back before the committee. My goal for today is to introduce a committee substitute and look to the will of the committee. We have a committee substitute for this bill. Is there a motion, Mr. Vice Chairman?
Chairman, I move to adopt Work order 33LS0474/U as our working document for the House Bill 104.
And I'll object for discussion. Who's coming forward to discuss this? Representative Kronk and Mr. Stancliffe and Mr. King. Mr. King, you need to explain the changes in the proposed committee substitute.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Ed King, staff to Chairman McKay. Mr. Chairman, the committee substitute makes a few additions to the bill to clarify the distinction between expedited timber sales and the salvage sales that is already in existing law. Mr. Chairman, the first change is the addition of the salvage sales to AS 3805035E. So this change begins on page 1, line 10, and it runs all the way to page 6. However, the change is located on page 4, lines 29 and 30. All of the rest of the provisions are existing law. The next change is to add two more provisions, sections 4 and 5 of the bill, which are on page 6. These are to exempt salvage sales and expedited timber sales from the forest land use plan and the five-year plan. Change number 3 is a new bill section 6. It's a new subsection D under 3805115. And this change is to allow longer timber sales contracts for industry, and unless there's a need or a request for a shorter time period. Change number 4 is the additions of bill sections 7 and 8, which are on page 6, starting on page 6, the very bottom of the page 6, mostly on page 7. This is language that's intended to clarify the difference between salvage sales and expedited timber sales. Mr. Chairman, I would clarify that salvage sales in general refer to timber that has already been killed by beetle killer fire, whereas expedited timber sales are preemptive measures to mitigate fire risk or infestation spread. Mr. Chairman, the change number 5 is bill section 9. It was added to encourage more high-value wood production in Alaska. That allows for the 7-year sales for negotiated sale for high-value wood. This was requested by some members of the industry in order to support financing efforts. Change number 6 changes the original language in the bill, which was section 3 of the original bill. It's now section 10. The changes include terms and conditions that better reflect the sponsor's intent. This is mostly recognizing that the expedited timber sales are preventing fire and infestation spread. This should save the administration money in those activities, and therefore the price that is being collected from those timber sales should reflect the savings to the state. There's also the addition of habitat degradation as a condition where expedited timber sales are allowed. This is due to the language in the original bill was very human focused, but there are situations where fire danger or infestation could be damaging to wildlife or habitat, and so this allows that same activity to occur in those situations. And then the last change within that section is to make clear that these new provisions are not intended to reduce the timber sales under other provisions. They are in addition to in circumstances where they're deemed necessary. And then, Mr. Chairman, the last change is just to add an effective date so that this can happen quickly. Any questions, Mr. Chairman? I'm happy to answer.
Yes, I have Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So I'm curious, Mr. King, page 7, line 26, why did we land on 7 instead of something greater? The loggers I know are having a horrible time getting financing for equipment because of the short time of the timber sale. The banks don't necessarily, they look at a 7-year timber sale and you might have a 30-year loan on a piece of equipment and it's just not meshing up for them. So I'm wondering why we landed on 7, I guess.
Mr. Chairman, I'll let Mr. Sankliff answer, but first I would direct the members to page 6, lines 23 through 30. specifically on line 25. This is the timber sales. The length of the term is 25 years unless it's requested or otherwise required by the commissioner. The seven-year sale provision that you were speaking to was specific to the 123 sales, which I'll let Mr. Stancliffe explain.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dave Stancliffe, staff to Representative Kronk. In working this out with the Department of Law, the Administration, Division of Forestry, Alaska Forest Association, and a number of other small-timer operators, this was set as a minimum of 7 years because anything less than that, the banks just turn their head.
It would be helpful if I could read. Thanks.
Well,
I missed the less than.
Okay.
Or not less than.
Representative Armstrong, you had your hand up.
I did, and this might be for the bill sponsor. I was just curious, like, for expedited timber sales when threat of fire, how is that decision made? Like, if there's an active fire, I'm just trying to envision, do we have logging trucks hauling butt down the road to, and how do we know, like, what's possibly going to get burned? I'm just curious about the science. I don't know much about timber sales. So I was curious specifically how that would work.
Mr. Chairman,
Stancliffe wanted, or?
Mr. Chairman, that question is probably best directed to the department as a general policy for fire prevention and suppression activities. I'm happy to schedule some time with one of them to meet with the committee if you like.
Rep. Armstrong, I'm not sure we have somebody here that could, you know, authoritatively answer.
That's okay. It's more of a curious question.
Mr. Chairman, I might offer some clarification. Dave Stancliffe here for the record. In the area that we live in, timber amounts to one of two things. It amounts to boards and cabin logs or it gets burned. The area around us has been burned on three quarters. There's one quarter left. So in areas that are fire prone and mature timber is standing there, and needs to be harvested, and there's a use for it, this would be come under the expedited classification so that it accomplishes two things. It obviously feeds the enterprise that's there that needs it, but it also offers another degree of protection against fires. The mature timber goes up very quickly, very fast, and very hot, and it's mature, so we want to see young carbon-capturing trees come up. So this is kind of worked into the middle between what's needed and what's public safety oriented. Does that help at all?
That answers my question. Thank you. Really interesting.
Okay, very good. Representative Rauscher?
Yeah, I was going to ask the maker of the original whether he supports this CS. And that's all I really want to know, whether or not he supports the CS.
Mr. Chairman, I wouldn't be here if he didn't, but he has quorum for finance, and so he is absent. But I will put my hand up, and hopefully that's good enough. I don't have a Bible, but there he is.
The question is, do you support the committee substitute, Representative Kronk?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mike Kronk, District 36, yes, I do support this.
Okay, you can leave now.
We cross all the T's and dot all the I's here in resources. All right. Are there any other questions for Mr. King or Mr. Stancliffe? Okay, I will remove my objection. And then without further objection, version S is now before us. Are there remaining questions on the bill? Am I getting too far ahead? My script says S, okay. Version U. Okay, I beg your pardon. Version U is before us for the record. Are there any remaining questions? Are there any amendments? Apparently not. Does the sponsor have any closing comments? I think we've already covered that. All right. What is the will of the committee? Mr. Vice Chair, do you have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move to report. Committee substitute for House Bill 104, Work Order 33-LS0474/U from the committee with individual recommendations and one attached zero fiscal note.
Okay, I hear no objections. So
Committee substitute House Bill 104 Resources has been reported from the House Resources Committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note. We will take a brief at ease to sign the report. Okay, we're back on the record. House Resources, consideration of appointees is our next topic. We are going to consider first Mr. Michael Flores to the Big Game Commercial Services Board and Jacob Fletcher to the Board of Game. So, Mr. Flores, can you hear me okay?
I can. How about me?
Yeah, maybe just a little bit louder.
There is an echo.
Try it again, Mr. Flores. Let's do a sound check.
Sure. How about now? Yeah, I'm still hearing my voice.
It's not bad, but it could be a little better.
Yeah, for some reason, there's an echo. I'm hearing everything I say again.
Okay, let's take a brief at ease. We'll take a brief at ease while they work out the technology. On the record, Mike Flores, I recommend that you call us on a regular phone line. I can give you the number. Where are you calling from? Can you hear me, Mike?
Can you guys hear me now?
Yeah, where are you calling from, Mike?
I'm so sorry, I can't hear you guys.
Okay, let's go to the next candidate, and we'll try to come back to Mike, okay? Is that all right? Okay, we're going to skip Mike Flores just for a few moments, and we'll go to Mr. Where are you here? Jacob Fletcher. Jacob, can you hear me all right?
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yeah, that's much better. Speak up now. So, Mr. Fletcher, please state your name and your affiliation for the record, and do you have any prepared remarks for your position on the Board of Game?
Yes, sir. For the record, my name is Jacob Fletcher, and I'm up for reappointment to the Board of Game. I have prepared a very short statement here, if it's appropriate for me to say it at this time.
Yes, sir. Please proceed.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and all the members of the committee. I live in Sopetna. I'm married. We have 10-year-old twins. I own a small, big game guiding business that predominantly operates on Kodiak Island for several weeks in the spring and in the fall. I was also recently awarded a federal guide use area on the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge, and I'm very much looking forward to operating there starting in 2024. In the summer months, I operate a vessel for Mahane Jet Boat Adventures in Sopetna. In this job, I introduce guests to flora and fauna and the history of our little piece of the Susitna River and the Talkeetna River. In the winter months, I own and operate a small snow machine tourism business, and I occasionally help out guiding and training at Dallas Seabee's dog kennel there in Talkeetna, and that is a business that my wife manages for him. My family and I are avid outdoors people. We feel very blessed to live in a state that affords us so much opportunity when it comes to filling our freezers. I've worked as a packer, an assistant guide, and a registered guide for over 20 years, and I'm very familiar with the way that game regulations are implemented in the field. I've served one previous term on the Board of Game. The commitment by the Department of Fish and Game, the Department of Law, the Subsistence Division, and the Board support staff that work tirelessly to make sure the board members and the public are informed, as well as our local AC's participation and all the members of the public that participate, make this process quite simply the best in the world, and I feel very blessed and humbled to have been a part of it. As a consumptive and a non-consumptive user, I will continue to look out for the wild game of the state as well as its residents. I would appreciate an affirmative vote when it comes to my confirmation. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions you might have for me at this time. Thank you.
Okay, do we have any questions for Mr. Jacob Fletcher?
I do.
Okay, Representative McCabe has a question for you, Jacob.
Hey, Jacob, it's Representative McCabe. I used to fly for Alaska Trophy Safaris on Kodiak, so real familiar with what you do and guiding and such out there. But I wanted to ask you a question. This morning we turned down a portion of a bill that would have the legislature would have directed disabled vets and old people like me be able to use electric bikes in a non-motorized hunting area. And I wonder what your thoughts are on this. A reason for turning it down was because we didn't feel like we should be managing what the big game board, the game board manages. We shouldn't be doing it from the floor of the legislature. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that, and I'm wondering if the game board would consider maybe suggesting certain areas where disabled vets could, in fact, use a motorized or electric bicycle in a non-motorized hunt area.
Hey, thank you very much for the question, Representative McCabe, and through the chair. I guess it would be my position that we'd be very interested in that. From time to time, we hear a lot of folks that come to our meetings that testify that are disabled. We had a proposal about a proposed moose hunt for disabled folks in Kincaid Park in Anchorage that we just approved. So to answer that question, absolutely yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions for Mr. Fletcher? Okay. Does any member of the public wish to test? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Pukta.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Fletcher, and this will be similar questioning for all confirmees of the Board of Game. We're dealing with some issues in game management 23, 26, A, B, and C, which is all of District 40. And I was trying to look up the different herds that are encompassed there, but I know there's some dwindling herd numbers, I believe, in the Western Arctic. But we have the Tajikpuk, the Central Arctic, and the Porcupine herd, along with that other one. And on the advisory committee level, dealing with the potential of scale back from whatever the daily limit per person is to an annual limit. And I wanted to kind of get... Feel your pulse on the subsistence preference, and I guess part of that comes from on the advisory committee level. If we're going to do the scale back, what the feel is from that advisory committee level is if we're going to do the scale back for subsistence preference, then there should be a scale back for the commercial take also. And I wanted to get your opinion and stance on that kind of subsistence versus commercial take in the management philosophy.
Thank you very much for that question, Representative Potok, and through the chair. It's whenever we're dealing with animals that are in abundance,
It's incredibly easy, especially when the science supports it. But when we're dealing with animals, that the numbers are dwindling, that's where it gets. It gets really incredibly difficult. And whenever we're talking about areas that I'm not really familiar with, I rely wholeheartedly on the local AC's input. Those advisory committees, they work incredibly hard to get together. You know, sometimes, it isn't like in Tuckeeville, where I live, where everybody just goes down to the library. You have people traveling very, very far distances. I know the board support staff really worked hard to get people connected with telephonically so that we can get a really good idea of what the local people that live up there think about a certain subject. So to answer your question, you know, whenever we're have a animal that's incredibly abundant, that makes it really easy. But whenever we're doing that, absolutely, commercial use has to get scaled back as well. Does that answer your question, sir?
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Rauscher.
Yeah, thank you. Apparently I didn't do my homework and realized we were going to do an interview like this today. But I do have a question. As the state starts to create hunts where only the local clientele are able to apply for the hunt, and I get letters as a legislator, and the letters say, well, Alaska's game is for everybody. Alaska's game should have an equal opportunity for everyone to participate. So when we start looking at those localized hunts, I was wondering, what's your opinion on that particular idea as we start moving into that realm here, it seems, in the state?
Thank you very much for the question, and through the chair to Vice Chairman Rauscher. Yeah, I think you're probably talking about the community harvest hunt. Is that correct, sir?
Yeah, there's a single moose out there that the local community can go after, but yet there's a few others that I'm talking about, yes.
Yeah, yes, sir. I believe that all those different hunts that got implemented, I don't think that any user group is absolutely 100% satisfied with. And as we continue to work through this process, I hope that we can get all those user groups together and continue to work and tweak and refine those different hunts so that it's more agreeable to all user groups. Does that answer your question, sir?
I appreciate your answer, and I'll take it into account. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Fletcher? All right. Is it possible we could get Mike Flores back on the line? Oh, okay. Mike, can you hear me all right, Mr. Flores?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for having me today.
That's much better. Okay. Please state your name and your affiliation and any prepared remarks that you have, Mr. Flores. Please proceed.
On the Alaska Big Game Commercial Services Board as the marine transporter. Been in Alaska for 33 years. My wife up here came up as a bush pilot and a big game guide, and then transferred to become a marine transporter and fishing guide. Currently I've served on the board for the Alaska Charter Association and delegate to the International Pacific Halibut Commission for 5 years, along with recently the governor's task force for bycatch. That was 10 months of meetings. I think we had a total of 65 meetings in 10 months. And then recently just got appointed to the salmon task force as well. The first 3 years on the transport, doing transporter work, we've seen a lot of changes. Recently at the Board of Game, last month, we heard from Afognik Data Corporation and Zinke and Fort Lyons that they felt like they were being overran with transfers, and so
We're looking into that. I think there's still a lot of work to be done. Before the board sunsetted back in 95, we had a sticker for transporters to identify them, and so we're looking at bringing that back. And that would tell us, you know, if we do have a problem with too many transporters, or is it just, you know, the public out filling their freezers for the winter.
Okay, very well. Does anyone have any questions for Mr. Flores? Okay, seeing none. Does any member of the public wish to testify on the appointment of Mr. Flores and or Mr. Fletcher? Representative Puckett.
Sorry about that, Mr. Chairman. I was thinking about what he wrapped up with and whether or not that went to the point that I'd like to get fleshed out a little bit.
Okay, so Mr. Flores, Representative Puckett has a question for you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Flores, for your willingness to serve on the board again. Similar to the question that I asked Mr. Fletcher, as far as you know, the game management units that I represent are 23 and all of 26 in the sub-management units, and we're dealing with some issues with the decline in herd. You know, the AC forwarding some recommendations to scale back the subsistence take, and the question being arose as far as what does the commercial take scale back look like, and wanted to get your kind of opinion a little further. I know you touched on it a little bit as far as where you stand on those type of decision making.
Chair, thank you for the question. It appears that the, you know, the Kodiak AC and the villagers think there's a problem with too much harvest. And marine transporters, you know, and I can't speak for the air guys where you're talking about, but as far as marine stuff goes, you know, there's a lot of animals that are harvested off the beach. So at Board of Game this year, they did vote to reduce the harvest on non-residents to one buck only, which leaves more animals on the beach for the locals. And they left the harvest limit for locals alone, so it's still sitting at three for Kodiak. And I think they did a reduction for Southeast along similar lines for non-residents to reduce that as well. The biologist said that there was no reason for concern for doing a reduction, that the level of population of animals is still good. So we have seen an increase in transporters. Last year we had 22 new ones sign up, and we had 27 less registered guides last year. I think some of that was due to the fact that the areas you're talking about that got closed. So less guides, more transporters getting into it. This year so far we've had 12 new transporters sign up for licenses. So the transporters don't have a limit on them like guides have to test in order to become licensed in the state of Alaska. Transporters do not.
Oh, okay. Okay, Mr. Flores, let's see. We have one person on the phone to testify, Mr. Wayne Kubat. Did I say that right, Wayne? Can you hear me? Okay, please state your name and your affiliation, Wayne, and begin your testimony.
Yeah, good afternoon, Chairman McKay and House Resources Committee members. I'm Wayne Kuba, the Vice President of the Alaska Professional Hunters Association, and I'm speaking on their behalf. Alaska Professional Hunters Association supports the reappointment of Mr. Michael Flores to the Big Game Commercial Services Board. Mr. Flores has been an engaged and active member of the board and is especially knowledgeable concerning transporter issues. APHA believes that Mr. Flores brings unique and first-hand viewpoints and experiences to the board process. Also, that he has shown himself to be accessible to the public, willing to listen to all sides of an issue, committed to making the best decisions on issues that he possibly can. APHA respectfully asks that you support the appointment of Mr. Flores to the Big Game Commercial Services Board. Thank you for your consideration.
Okay, thank you very much, Wayne. I have another person on the line, looks like Mr. Mark Richards. Mark, can you hear me? Mark Richards, can you hear me?
Mr. Chairman, can you hear me?
There you are. Okay, yes, I can. Mark.
Problem recognizing me. For the record, my name is Mark Richards. I'm the executive director of Resident Hunters of Alaska. Organization has over 3,200 members from across the state, and we advocate for sustainable wildlife management policies geared toward enhancing and prioritizing resident hunting opportunities. I'm calling in from the Great Alaska Sportsman Show in Anchorage today from the stairwell. Well, hopefully it's a lot quieter. Again, thank you, Chair McKay, Vice Chair Rauscher, and members of the committee for taking my testimony. Regarding Mr. Fletcher's reappointment to the Board of Game, we have decided to remain neutral and just reiterate our position that the current makeup of the Board of Game is completely unbalanced in favor of commercial hunting interests in a way that is unprecedented. Mr. Fletcher is currently one of the five licensed guides and one retired guide on the seven-member Board of Game. To put that in some perspective, there are a bit over 100,000 resident Alaskans who purchase a hunting license every year. Less than 1% of those are licensed guides. If Mr. Fletcher is reappointed, he will then be one of four guides on the seven-member board, which is still an imbalance that shouldn't happen. This is a no-win situation for organization or our organization. If we oppose Mr. Fletcher's reappointment, we get wrongly dinged again for being against guides when we're only looking out for resident hunter interests. And we have no doubt that Jake will be confirmed. He's a good man. I have a lot of respect for him, and I don't expect you to vote against him now. If you voted for him the last time, this put even more guys on the board. I just want to make sure that you all understand where we're coming from. And I look forward to talking to some of you again soon on ways to reform the Board of Game as well as the Board of Fish. We're not managing our fish and wildlife on a pendulum swing that depends on who the current governor is, his or her choice for commissioner and Board of Game seat. We need to ensure balanced boards are in everyone's best interest. One last thing I'd like to point out, Mr. Representative Buckethuck's question to Mr. Fletcher about, you know, managing game that's not in abundance and should commercial be scaled back if subsistence is. I would just point out that Mr. Fletcher's answer was that commercial should be scaled back, but that isn't at all how he has voted on the Board of Game. And a perfect example is the situation we have with a severely declining sheep population in Unit 19C in the Western Alaska Range. For decades, non-resident guided hunters has taken 70 and 80% of the harvest every year out of that population. Our organization has been asking the Board of Game to limit non-resident sheep hunters there since our formation in 2016. Last month, Mr. Fletcher voted again against any limits on non-resident sheep hunters, and they took 90% of the sheep last year. So it's one thing to say that commercial should be scaled back when he's asked the question, but it's another thing when he sits on the Board of Game and then makes these decisions, and I just wanted to make that clear. Thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Okay, thank you, Mark. Thank you for your commentary, and I just want the committee and Mr. Fletcher to know that I will be giving Mr. Fletcher an opportunity to respond to those comments. Mr. Wayne Kubat, we're going to come back to you to comment on the candidacy of Mr. Fletcher. Can you hear me all right, Wayne?
Yes, I can. Chairman McKay and House Resource members. I'm Wayne Kuba, Vice President of APHA. APHA supports reappointment of Mr. Jake Fletcher to the Alaska Board of Game. Mr. Fletcher lives full-time in rural Alaska. He understands the unique challenges living and working remotely, and knows firsthand the importance of our wildlife resources to Alaska's rural community. APHA believes that Jake brings unique viewpoints and experiences from across the state to the board process. Also, that he has shown himself to be accessible to the public, willing to listen to all sides of an issue, and committed to making the best decisions on wildlife issues that he possibly can. APHA respectfully asks that you support the appointment of Mr. Fletcher to the Board of Game. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Wayne. Now I'd like to go back to Mr. Fletcher. Can you hear me all right, Jacob?
Yes,
Jacob, I feel a responsibility to ask you in response to the comments you just heard. Can this committee be assured that you will assume this responsibility and take into account the need for balance between all users of wildlife in Alaska?
Yes, sir, absolutely. I can give you a very short explanation if you would like, but rest assured that that's the case.
Well, why don't you give us a short response to Mr. Richards' comments for the record.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Yes, to the earlier question, I believe we were talking about caribou. Mr. Richards brought up a proposal that dealt with sheep. I'm a big believer, I believe wholeheartedly, in the full curl rule of management. That means a ram that is full curl or 8 years old is a ram that you can take. I believe that it leaves a harvestable amount of surplus on the hill every single year. As far as the subsistence hunt goes there, I think there's only been one sheep that's been taken in that winter subsistence hunt in a long time. I might be mistaken on that, but normally you have to fly into Nikolai and you have access to Egypt Mountain via the Iditarod Trail. So in my opinion, that we're talking a little bit like about two completely different subjects. Thank you.
All right, very well then. Are there any other questions from the committee for these two gentlemen? All right. Let the record reflect that in accordance with AS 3905080, the House Resources Committee held a hearing on Michael Flores and Jacob Fletcher. Sign in a committee report testifies to the members' participation in this hearing and does not reflect the intent of any member to vote for or against the confirmation during joint session. Mr. King will pass the committee report around as we move to the next item. Let me take a brief at ease to reset the table.
Okay, we're back on the record, House Resources, and the next subject today, and our final item is House Bill 98, and I'd like to welcome Representative Mears to our meeting today. Thank you, Representative, for attending. House Bill 98 is related to state ownership of submerged land. I will now bring House Bill 98 before the committee. This is our first hearing on this topic. My goal for today is to introduce the bill to the committee, then hold the bill until the Senate companion bill arrives. Representative Stadler, would you like to offer a sponsor statement?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Through the chair to the members of the committee, thank you for agreeing to hold this meeting. For the record, this is Representative Dan Sadler, House District 24, Chugach Eagle River. I have with me Mary Jackson, my chief of staff, and I will heed the admonishment to speak loudly and clearly into the microphone, which is one I've issued to witnesses before in this committee. Mr. Chairman, House Bill 98 seeks to end the federal government's decades-long unjust denial of a fundamental right that Alaska has, which is control of the navigable waters and the lands underneath them, regardless of whether they're in federal conservation units or not. At statehood in 1959, we obtained 105 million acres of land. In addition, the Constitution and federal law and precedent at the instant of statehood made the state also the owner of navigable waters and the lands underneath them. That constitutes more than 1 million acres of land and more than 18,000 miles of river. Now, navigable waters, what are, you might ask, what are they? Those are the waterways, lakes, creeks, water rivers that supported or could have at the point of statehood supported travel. They provide travel routes, they provide recreational recreational access, aquatic habitat, and more, and they represent corridors of commercial and recreational travel that are critical to our state's prosperity and sovereignty. Every other state in the Union, Mr. Chair, assumed undisputed control of these lands and waters inside their borders upon joining the Union. Now, despite their obligation to do so, our federal authorities have been dragging their feet in granting Alaska clear title to its submerged lands. Instead, they have essentially forced the state to approve to assert our claims of navigability on a case-by-case basis at a costly, slow rate that would take, frankly, hundreds of years to conclude at the rate we've been going. And this bill simply says enough is enough. It confidently declares Alaska's title to the beds of navigable waters, including those inside federal parks, wildlife refuges, forests, and other federal conservation system units, FSCUS. Unless, of course, they were specifically withdrawn before statehood, and there are a couple of such pre-statehood withdrawals, the Tongass National Forest for one. This bill identifies and clearly enumerates water bodies inside federal areas in which the state has a clear title interest, and it directs the Department of Natural Resources to make progress reports to us, the legislature, on its continuing efforts to delineate navigable waters in federal waters in Alaska, federal areas, rather. You might have heard about the sturgeon cases in the U.S. Supreme Court. The need for this bill is dramatized by sturgeon's cases. He's an Alaska hunter who fought and won 2 U.S. Supreme Court decisions clarifying Alaskans have the right to access and use navigable waters inside federal areas, and more importantly, that federal regulations do not trump state ownership, even inside these conservation units created by the Alaska National Lands Conservation Act of 1980. Mr. Chairman, we have a couple folks here. I've got folks from DNR who are going to offer some more details, but I'm going to invite my Chief of Staff, Mary Jackson, to deliver a sectional analysis of the bill, with your permission.
Okay. Good to see you, Mrs. Jackson. Please proceed with the sectional analysis.
Thank you so much, Chair McKay and Vice Chair Roucher and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Jackson. I'm staff to Representative Sadler. Is that coming through loud enough?
It seems to be a little faint from those two. Must be a...
unusual. Is that better?
Okay. A little better. Thanks.
For the record, my name is Mary Jackson. I'm staff to Representative Sadler. We passed out yesterday 3-ring binders for each one of your offices, and in that is a 2-page sectional analysis. And in the interest of time, which I know we are limited on, I'm not going to sit here and read it. It's pretty straight up. We'll go into the presentation by DNR. I do want to point out a couple things on it. It's an 88-page bill. Section 9 encompasses 83 of those pages, which is that very detailed list of waterways, many of which are no-named. So that's kind of a fun thing. It's a future opportunity, I guess you could say. But with that, Mr. Chairman, if there are no specific questions, I'm prepared to vacate my chair and bring the department people up to go through this presentation.
Very well. Okay, thank you, Mrs. Jackson, for that presentation. And now I'll call on Brent Goodrum from the Department of Natural Resources. Brent, you're next up to begin a presentation on this topic for us. Thank you, Representative Sadler. So please put your name on the record and begin your presentation, Mr. Goodrum.
Thank you, Chair McKay. For the record, Deputy Commissioner Brent Goodrum, I've been working these navigability issues for the vast majority of my almost 12 years with the department. So the state of Alaska can only bring a quiet title action in federal court when there's a case or controversy. Oftentimes, the federal government simply won't take a position on the ownership of submerged lands, effectively denying the state a case or controversy. But the federal government won't definitively say they explicitly have ownership interests either. The legislation before you today effectively flips the script. Should the Alaska legislature act and codify these navigable water bodies in federal areas as navigable in fact for title purposes, the federal government is put on formal notice that we, the state, own these submerged lands and that we, the state, intend to manage these water bodies even though they flow through post-statehood federal conservation system units. If the federal government disagrees with the state's position, the burden is now upon the federal government to gather data and to find resolution. Gone will be the days when a federal conservation system unit enforcement officer can say they simply didn't know, or indicate to the Bureau of Land Management hasn't made an affirmative decision or determination, so they will continue to act and enforce as they always have. After two unanimous U.S. Supreme Court decisions on point in this matter in Sturgeon v. Frost, continuing to act in the same manner is no longer an option for the state of Alaska. The current status quo of uncertainty and ambiguity of ownership, management, and control of our state's navigable water bodies is simply not in our state's best interest. I don't believe it to be in anyone's best interest. For 64 years, we have patiently waited for federal authorities to make their determinations known to us with regards to the navigability of our water bodies. At this glacial pace, we would need hundreds of years more. Taking the same linear approach for even one day longer and expecting a different result or response from our federal counterparts is simply not good land management. The time is now for us to flip the script. We need to lead. We, the state of Alaska, need to decisively take action to identify and codify our navigable rivers and lakes for current and future generations of Alaskans so that they confidently know with whom ownership, management, and control rightly rests. After all, at the end of the day, the state ought to be able to manage its property fully knowing what its property is. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will now flip slides for Jim Walker, who is the section manager of the Public Access Assertion and Defense Unit, and he is on Teams today, regrettably because of transportation issues between here in Anchorage. So I will hand the mic over to Mr. Walker.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Goodrum. Are there any questions at this moment for Mr. Goodrum? Okay, seeing none, Mr. Walker, can you hear us all right?
Yes, thank you, Chair McKay. Did you hear me all right?
Not really. Maybe.
Is this any better?
I think it's probably at our end. We seem to have some bad technology today. Let's just take a brief at ease and let the gentleman see if they can get it a little better. Just hold on, everybody. Brief at ease. Okay, we're back on the record. House Resources, Representative Puckatuck on HB 98. A couple questions for Mr. Goodrum from the DNR.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Josiah Puckatuck, District 40. Mr. Goodrum, a couple of questions regarding, I guess, intended consequence in the end as far as vessel traffic through navigable waters and the potential for political subdivisions of the state to take permitting authority to some degree of access to navigable waters. If you could speak to the intent of the administration, and I guess Mr. Sadler, Representative Sadler, through this bill.
Through the chair, Representative Putkatuk. Principally, you know, the state believes that as of 1959, under the Equal Footing Doctrine, all navigable waters within the state rightfully vested with the state. And so the state, as of that time, has had the opportunity, or should have, to effectively manage these water bodies. Through the decades, that isn't necessarily what we've observed, because the federal government really hasn't acknowledged our ownership rights to date. What ownership of those submerged lands gives us is the ability to not only the resources beneath those submerged lands, whether they are oil, gas, mineral in nature, or simply gravels in some areas, but also activity above them with regards to transportation. For the example of when Mr. Sturgeon was using his hovercraft on the Nation River, that river had already been determined navigable in a federal court of law. And so Mr. Sturgeon's comments were that he believed he was on state land, and therefore state regulations should apply as opposed to Park Service regulations. Park Service regulations prohibit hovercraft from operating within their parks. The water body he was on was not a park. It was an inholding within the park. I may have to circle back to you, because I think I may slightly be missing your question, but happy to follow up further with you.
Follow-up?
I could do offline follow-up. I guess where I'm getting is where political subdivisions, either a municipality, a borough, can assume the authority that the state is assuming, if it's within their first-class status or not. Is that the intent of the passage of this?
Through the chair, Representative Putkatuk, I believe the intent here is to verify that the state is the rightful entity, and the state would be the one that would be the one determining what types of access would be appropriate on those water bodies.
Okay, Mr. Goodrum, Representative McCabe has a question.
Yeah, so just to put a few things on the record, and I'm pretty sure you can answer these. We've had this conversation before, so. Can you tell me what a navigable water is? I mean, in the Coast Guard, navigable water is somewhere in the salt or access to the salt, but for the purposes of what we're trying to do, a navigable water has a set definition, and I'm almost certain you know that.
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, Mr. Walker will definitively share that with you further. There are court stipulations, court rulings that kind of explain that, but essentially, if you're able to use an customary, ordinary vessel that for travel, trade, travel, or commerce, essentially within the state, you know, it's as of statehood. So in 1959, what were customary and ordinary craft at that time? We look a lot different than the lower 48. Many of those states on the East Coast, we've got a lot of different technology that was available at that point. To truly give you the proper definition, I am going to defer to Mr. Walker, because he's very well versed in it.
Okay, and follow up if you would.
Yeah, follow up.
Thanks. So the issue has been the federal government's inability or unwillingness to agree with. I think you and I probably, and Mr. Walker, had a discussion about Basharoff, biggest lake essentially in South Central, maybe even the biggest in Alaska. It's a huge lake. You can absolutely take a boat on it. You can take a canoe. You can take a hovercraft. You can probably take a big cruise ship on it. It's so big and deep. And it took the federal government more than 10 years to declare or agree with us that that was a navigable water. If I remember our conversation, it was last year, but. And so this is what we're trying to do, is to expedite the ability to declare a river or a body of water navigable so that we know and they know and everybody knows whose water it is so that we don't run into another court case like Sturgeon. Is that pretty much the crux of what we're trying to do here?
That is correct, Representative McKay. Absolutely.
Thanks.
Representative Pukatuk.
Yeah, I guess not knowing if we'll get Mr. Walker online.
Yeah, we got him on the phone. Yeah. Sorry. Okay, so we have Mr. Walker on the phone to discuss House Bill 98. Mr. Walker, can you hear me okay?
Yes, did you hear me, Chair McKay?
Yeah, that's much better, and please speak up. And we are already on slide 2 of your presentation, so Mr. Goodrum will flip your slides, and please proceed.
Thank you so much, Chair McKay, members of the House Resources Committee. For the record, my name is Jim Walker. I am the Section Chief for the Public Access Assertion and Defense Team within the Division of Mines, Land, and Water, Alaska Department of Natural Resources. And as we have switched technologies, I have been hearing bits and pieces of the questions, and please, I would encourage folks to ask them again if I can provide clarity. But what I would like to do initially is to frame the issue of why these navigable waters are so important. And if you look statewide, Alaska has approximately 800,000 miles of navigable rivers and has approximately 30 billion acres of navigable lakes. As Deputy Commissioner Goodrum has already indicated, as well as sponsor Representative Sadler have indicated, the state of Alaska, pursuant to the Equal Footing Doctrine, the Federal Submerged Lands Act, and the Alaska Statehood Act, owns the submerged lands under each and every navigable, in fact, or tidally influenced water statewide, except those that were withdrawn by a valid pre-statehood withdrawal, right? The key is there, a pre-statehood withdrawal. Anything after statehood, particularly Anilka CSU areas, the state in the vast majority of those areas owns the submerged land under the Navigable Act and tidally influenced water. So if we move to the next slide, we can see that in many of the federal areas statewide, and we list them as the National Park Service areas, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service areas, Forest Service areas, and BLM lands, you will see that in the vast majority of those areas, it is the state, not the federal government, that owns the submerged land under federal areas. Under navigable, in fact, waters and tidally influenced waters. Let me highlight a couple of these, if I might. Katmai National Preserve. Within Katmai, there was a central nucleus, an original core, that was withdrawn pre-statehood. So within that central core, the state does not own the submerged land. Those were expressly withdrawn. However, think of concentric circles. Katmai was added to after statehood through Anilka and otherwise. For all of those post-statehood additions, the state does, in fact, own the submerged land. The same is true of Denali Park and Preserve. In Denali, the McKinley Monument, a pre-statehood withdrawal expressly includes the submerged lands, meaning the state doesn't own those submerged lands. In all of the post-statehood additions, the state of Alaska owns those submerged lands. So we see statewide, in most federal areas, it is the state that is the owner of the submerged lands. Why is this very important? If we could go to the next slide, please. If you look at everything that the federal government has acknowledged from the date of statehood onward, the federal government has only acknowledged state ownership of approximately 9% of our 800,000 miles of navigable rivers and only Representative Sadler and Deputy Commissioner Goodrum have indicated at this rate, it will take hundreds of years. It's motivated by the Sturgeon 1 and 2 decisions. Next slide, please. The state has intensified its statehood defense efforts, of which this particular legislation is a key part. Next slide, please. You will see that on the slide before you, this is a bubble chart that essentially shows all of the diverse ways that the Alaska Department of Natural Resources, working with the Alaska Department of Law, are attempting to fulfill those fundamental promises of statehood, namely the promises pursuant to the Equal Footing Doctrine and other federal law that we own these diverse lands. They are state sovereign property. So to that end, we have intensified our litigation against federal authorities when there is a conflict between state and federal government regarding who owns the submerged land. And for those areas where the federal government, I would say, conveniently has taken the position that maybe it is navigable, maybe it isn't. And until such time as we say it is navigable, we're going to treat it as not navigable. And so for those areas of uncertainty, we have intensified our efforts to delineate where the state owns those submerged lands. We are doing it through our management action. We are doing it through state mapping efforts on our navigable waters map. And we would respectfully submit this legislation, which codifies state ownership of submerged lands in federal areas, is a key way of essentially expediting the fruits of this promise of statehood, the ownership of state submerged land. So, turning to the bill specifically,
Mr. Walker, if I could interrupt you, Representative Rauscher has a question, please.
I appreciate the presentation by everybody here in the room, but I have a question. When we're talking about submerged lands, are we also including man-made lakes or ponds? If you've created one yourself, who owns that now?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, a very good question. And the exact answer to that, I would submit, is made on a case-by-case basis. For example, if you impound water that is free-flowing to create some type of dam structure where there is a pond, a lake, or whatever, the waters themselves are never owned privately. The waters are owned by the people of the state of Alaska pursuant to the public trust doctrine. However, if you are impounding that water and creating a larger footprint of submerged land, those submerged lands for a man-made pooling of waters do not necessarily belong to the state of Alaska. So to your question, it's made on a case-by-case basis. The water itself belongs to the public. The question of whether or not the submerged lands are in public ownership or private ownership is going to depend on a lot of case-specific information.
I appreciate the answer. Thank you very much.
Okay, Mr. Walker, please proceed.
Thank you. Through the chair, the legislation itself has four principal things that it does. One, it codifies state of Alaska ownership, management, and control of navigable waters and submerged lands within federal areas that are not covered by a valid pre-statehood withdrawal that expressly includes the submerged lands. It contains a very lengthy list, as Barry Jackson had earlier indicated, that specifically identifies is claiming within these federal areas belong to the state of Alaska. The legislation further enshrines fundamental principle derived from the federal case law concerning the standards that the state should use in making adaptability determinations. And lastly, it contains an annual reporting requirement, whereby if this legislation passes, every year at the beginning of session, I would come before this legislature and say what we have done here in the original bill, we should add to that list as our work within DNR continues. So, to break down those four points with greater particularity, one, codifies state ownership, management, and control of specific navigable waters and submerged lands within the federal area. What's the point of this? Well, the point of it is we want to make it crystal clear for everyone, for the general public, for federal agencies, for state adjudicators considering permit applications, etc., what it is exactly that the state owns. We're hoping that this educational aspect of the legislation will make the job easier, more efficient for state adjudicators of permit applications, will clarify in the public's mind, do I need to apply to the state for a permit, or is this a matter that falls within federal jurisdiction? We believe that this legislation also reflects the reality, right? It reflects what is truly navigable within these federal areas, and very boldly plant the state flag onto state land that we own. Next slide, please. The second phase is the listing of rivers. And even though the list is already long, if this legislation passes, the list will become longer, because this first tranche of waters that have been considered in the bill are all National Park Service areas statewide, both the Chugach and Tongass National Forests, and one U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service refuge, specifically the Tetlet Refuge. This is the work my team has done to date. We have had five people, in addition to their other responsibilities, poring over these areas, studying closely all of the aerial imagery, studying closely prior navigability reports prepared by federal authorities, looking at usage that we have a historical record of, to make these assessments of where the navigable waters within these federal areas begin and end. We've worked our way through NPS areas, U.S. Forest Service areas, and one wildlife refuge. If the bill passes, next session, we would be back before you, hopefully having concluded our U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service work, and say we would ask you to add all of these rivers that are found within additional U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service refuges. The following year, it would be my hope that we would come before you and say, here's the list of navigable and tidally influenced waters within BLM area statewide. Afterwards, we would have an ongoing quality assurance, quality control responsibility that DNR would hold to the legislature, that we would come back before you to correct anything on the listing that is contained within statute that might need updating, for example. If we were to prevail in litigation that we have against the federal government, the federal courts might say that our estimate of adaptability was too conservative, that we owned the submerged lands farther upstream. And so we would ask that the listing for that particular water be amended to conform to the latest that we have from the federal courts. We didn't come up with this system whereby we number these waters with a state water federal area number in a vacuum. methodology that the legislature used in the 1990s when they decided to codify RS-2477 rights of way across the state. So what we do is make it very simple for the public. If the bill passes, these bumpers, each of these waters that we are discussing, would relate to a digital online map that is maintained by the Department of Natural Resources. So the public, federal agencies, everyone would be able to see exactly what it is that the state owns. If I may, by moving to the next slide.
Okay, Mr. Walker, I think we had a question. Did we have a question? No questions. Okay, I beg your pardon. I thought I had a question. Go ahead, please. Sorry.
Thank you. Through the chair, please, with the technical difficulties, if I'm not hearing a question, please accept my sincere apologies. I do apologize. I'm not trying to talk over anyone. But moving to the slide before us, this is what depicts the current state of navigability according to federal authority. On the slide in front of you, you will see depicted in tan areas, federal areas statewide. The blue on the map represents places where there is agreement and the federal government has acknowledged state ownership. Pink on this map represents areas where the federal government has generally said, you know, maybe it is navigable, maybe it isn't. We haven't yet decided, so we are going to continue acting like it's not navigable until such time as we complete our determination. This ongoing ambiguity on their part, this ongoing status quo of uncertainty, we submit frustrates state interest. So if we could look to the next slide, as this depicts what visually everything that is included within the statute today. You will see that many of the pink areas have become blue. We have taken it upon ourselves through our navigability assessment to indicate those areas that are truly navigable, in fact, and tidally influenced according to federal law. We have applied those standards in making these determinations. So you'll see, if we could flip back to the preceding slide, which is slide 10, and then pan to slide 11.
It's like an eye test. It's like an eye test, Mr. Walker.
To really do justice to the state of Alaska and its vastness when we look at it, you know, on an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper. So let's drill down and look at it more at a granular level. So looking at the next slide, what we show is the Noatak and Kobuk Valley National Park. The Noatak is the one above. It's tan. The one below is the Kobuk Valley National Park, depicted in green. And you will see that in these areas, the federal government has only acknowledged state ownership of two rivers. On the lower one, the Kobuk River, as it runs through the Kobuk Valley Park. And then partially, the Noatak River, as it runs through the Noatak Preserve. You will also see, in connection with the confluence of what is the Aniuk River, that the color blue becomes a hybrid blue-red color. In that particular area, that depicts a portion of the river that the federal government has said is non-navigable. And just for a bit of context, that confluence with the Aniuk River is approximately 300 feet wide. The cubic feet per second rate of water that goes through that confluent is over 3,000 CFS. It is a huge river that the federal government says is not navigable and will be subject to litigation that the state will be filing later this year or early next year. But with that aside, put to one side, let's look at what this bill does. This bill specifically looks at all of those other pink waters depicted on the map. And we do the assessment that the federal government has not undertaken today. And after our work and what is contained within the legislation, let's flip to the next slide. This is what the bill does. It specifically says that each of those rivers depicted in blue is state property owned, managed, and controlled by the state of Alaska. So, Deputy Commissioner Goodrum, if we could pass back between slides 12 and 13, please. This is what this legislation does. This, everything that is depicted visually on this map relates to something contained within, an entry contained within the proposed legislation.
Okay, Mr. Walker, quite a visual, quite a stunning difference, and we appreciate that. So we're getting a little short on time. Please proceed.
Absolutely. Chair McKay, thank you. They build up several other things. It enshrines the federal standards of navigability, which we follow in making all of our navigability determinations, and it enshrines them within state law, specifically principles regarding the types of watercraft that are appropriate for use in determining navigability, what susceptibility means, and what navigability does require and doesn't require. Next slide, please. It further defines the geographic scope of this legislation. Earlier, I had heard a bit of a question that Representative Puckettuck had asked regarding the exact scope of this legislation, what it does cover and what it doesn't cover. Specifically, it only covers federally owned land, that are in areas managed by federal authorities. It does not address native corporation land or private property in any way. Lastly, the bill, in terms of definitions, defines key terms for a better understanding of the methodology and the law and principles regarding use of state-owned submerged land and navigability, specifically relating to what ordinary high water mark means, what the line of feed high tide means, and other key terms. And then lastly, the next slide, please. It establishes the annual reporting requirement that I have already discussed. To conclude with the last slide, it has been 64 years since statehood. There has been little progress made on the federal front in acknowledging state ownership of submerged land. This bill takes a bold step in asserting to the federal government and calling the question of who owns what, in the hopes that either federal authorities will acknowledge the work that we have done, or alternatively, will disagree and give us the necessary standing to vindicate in the courtroom, in federal court, state ownership rights in this essential aspect of Alaska's birthright.
Okay, Mr. Walker, as always, you give a great presentation, and that was very informative. Do we have any questions from the committee? Okay, well, I'd like to thank Mr. Walker, Mr. Goodrum for being with us today, Mr. Sadler and Mrs. Jackson. So we will now set aside HB 98 in committee while we wait for the Senate
version of the bill to come forward. Is there any other business for us today? Okay, seeing none, the next House Resources Committee meeting will be held at 1 o'clock on Monday, April 17th. This meeting is adjourned at 2:43 p.m. Thank you.